Good morning, everybody. As we've known, this is SPAT's closing day, the getaway day. Hopefully for some of you, you're staying a little bit longer. I'm Michael Eisen. I'm here to talk about a subject which is very near and dear to me. I grew up in Florida playing baseball. I still enjoy seeing some of my favorite athletes to examine are the overhead throwing athletes. And to say this is my term, this disabled throwing shoulder, that's not accurate. This is actually a term that was used by Stephen Burkhardt up the road in San Antonio. Him and two other orthopedic surgeons, Morgan and Kibler, the so-called orthopedic three amigos, came up with this term back in the early 2000s. And they published three papers, which still are very relevant today, even though they're approximately 15 years old, and they cover this topic called the disabled throwing shoulder. We're going to see a couple of those items from their articles down the road a little bit. Of course, Greg Maddux in any uniform, he was the antithesis of the disabled throwing shoulder with his form. And we're going to go through what makes a successful intervention as far as biomechanics a little bit down the road. In terms of conflicts, no conflicts. I would like to disclose, though, I used to be more of an ardent baseball fan until I watched the Roger Clemens testimony. The steroid talk really, the testimony to Congress really threw it off for me, so I see the game a little bit more tainted today. So that could be seen as a conflict. Again, thank you to SPATS for having me speak on this topic. And of course, as we mentioned, happy Father's Day. So our objectives. Upon completion of this presentation, we should be able to understand what we're up against in terms of the risk and the extent of upper extremity pathology. And we're not going to dig deep into the pathology. We're just going to take it from a glancing blow, so to speak. We're going to discuss biomechanics of the overhead throwing athlete. The work of Atwater and Glenn Fleissig at ASMI. I mean, these are people who have really dedicated time and research, and they know this on a whole different level than I do, greater than I ever will. But I think we should have a basic understanding of the biomechanics of our throwing athletes. We should be able to competently assess our throwing athlete's style in this day and era of iPads, iPhones, things where we can put our players and athletes on slow motion, and we can watch it. For example, when I see people for concussions, most of the time they'll come to me and say, well, here's a picture of the hit, and everything is recorded these days, so we should be doing the same. We will understand why the disabled throwing shoulder accolade is very appropriate for the athlete. We'll talk about briefly, and this kind of hits to the point of it, why is it difficult to treat these athletes and why we should focus more on prevention. We'll talk about risk factors that the overhead throwing athlete has, whether that be at the beginning of the season or during the course of a season. We'll review a couple studies. There's many out there. I picked two or three from the high school scenario for which strength and conditioning does play a role and is shown to help in terms of overhead throwing athletes. And lastly, we'll implement, or my choice, of an overhead throwing athlete program. So our job in the healthcare field, obviously, is prevention. And this is something I see on a daily basis with these throwers. I apologize, I didn't grab x-rays from the office for the first one, but this one is the classic Little League shoulder, and you see the widening of the growth plate on the outside as the first manifestation. It can progress. I've seen a couple of these in young girls, softball players, 10 years of age, where you get this widening on both sides of the growth plate with demineralization. I've never seen a stage 3 yet where they actually had that slipped epiphysis, but I'm sure they're coming, and we'll talk about why that is in a moment. The x-rays on the bottom, this comes from a local high school where two of their pitchers I saw recently, both with elbow problems. And you can see here, this growth plate on the medial epicondyle is definitely involved. We did an MRI, that's an acute stress fracture, and he received a compression screw. When I saw this athlete, and I ask every overhead throwing athlete, what exercises do you do? And their first, I mean, they blurt out almost instantly, bench press, squat, and somewhere around the way, they'll say something about a lunge. And I'll ask them, well, what about this? What about, and it's not there. So I think we really need to focus more on prevention to keep them out of this so-called boneyard here. So going through our set of objectives, first we'll touch on this, what we're up against and the pathologies. Back at Troy, my mentor, Chuck Ash, used to say, all coaches were former players. So from a former player's perspective, i.e. the coaches, this is an article taking us through whether or not coaches are aware of the compliance of pitching rules that have been outlined by USA Baseball. And just to go real quick to the summary of this article, what they said is most coaches are not aware of the information put forth by USA Pitching, and the recommendations of their knowledge is poor. The little graph on the side there, which you see, this area in the gray, this is the coaches at various levels, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And this is their thoughts, thinking they're in line with the recommendations. The one in the black is they think what their other coaches are doing wrong. So you can see here, they think they're doing everything right while the other team's coaches are doing everything wrong. And it's a bit of introspection on the coach's brain. Enough about the coaches, let's talk about players. This was a recent journal article from 2015 asking players up to the age of 18 about injury prevention. And I just took two of the graphs from that article. One was, have you heard of USA Medical and Safety, the pitching guidelines? An overwhelming 8 to 9 out of 10 said no. What body part are you most likely to injure when it comes to baseball? The number one area, ankle. Almost half the people said ankle. Almost a third said elbow. And since this was done in 2015, I think we're seeing a bit of this overrun from the Tommy John epidemic that we're seeing, so that it's on the radar. But nowhere mentioned is the shoulder. Just in terms of risk, the shoulder and elbow are the most commonly injured areas in the overhead throwing athlete due to this attrition or this repetitive microtrauma. As I alluded to in the prior slide, there's an epidemic, as we're very well aware, of Tommy John procedures. There was a stat in 2014, more ulnar collateral ligament reconstructions were done in the major leagues than all of the 1990s. So that puts it in perspective. Less than 1% of all baseball players participate in the collegiate or professional ranks. So that means 99% of the population falls underneath our watch. 99% of these athletes don't have a pitching coach. They don't have someone to cue them up and go through what is going on with their windup. So really, again, it falls on us. And we see here just on the graph of this is Tommy John and Dr. Frank Job, one of the few physicians in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame for what he did for the sport. And you can see on the rise, so the ulnar collateral ligament reconstructions. In terms of data on injuries, this was a study from 2012, and they took 6 years of Major League Baseball, and they looked at all the injuries from within. And over a period from 2005 to 2008, there was almost a 40% increase in injuries. Not surprisingly, April, most commonly associated with the most injuries, beginning of the season. The end of the season is September, the least amount of injuries. And if we look at that data, I think maybe it's because most of the people might already be on the disabled list. However, the takeaway was pitchers are third. They have 33% practically a higher incidence of injuries versus position players. Here's just the graph showing us from 2005 to 2008, the red one being pitchers, blue is all players, position players on the bottom. And focusing on the other graph here, or the picture rather, pitchers only, you can see here overwhelmingly upper extremity, even though this includes the entirety of the arm, but it's going to be upper extremity. And looking at the top, all players, AL, NL, 50% are involved in the upper extremity. Big graph, a lot of numbers. Again, the takeaway, if you look at pitchers at the top here, overwhelmingly elbow, shoulder, elbow, 1-2. Those are the takeaways. And so their conclusion was, for Major League Baseball, we need to look at the effectiveness of off-season and preseason training and in-season conditioning programs. We should look at them more closely so we can implement an evidence-based approach. And that's in Major League Baseball. These are people who already have, I'm sure they have programs going right and left, as I've already, I was involved in it, and these guys are doing programs daily. So just in high school, you're going to miss some games. That's unfortunate. College, on a higher level. At LSU, we lost a guy in Super Regionals, which really affected our team. Fortunately, we were able to capitalize still. But looking at the front office vantage point in Major League Baseball, you look at our friend from the Arizona Diamondbacks here. He makes $35 million a year. Based on his stats last year, that's about $1 million a game, $300,000 an hour. He threw almost 3,300 pitches last year, so that equates to $10,000 a pitch. And if he walks somebody intentionally, that's $40,000 in the pocket. So from the front office perspective, injuries are a big deal. Let's talk a little bit about biomechanics for a moment. And again, I'm not going to go into a breakdown level, but I think we should look at it from at least a good perspective. It takes about 1 second to complete the baseball motion. It used to be 4 phases, but later on got a change to 6 phases, and each one is named for its major contribution to the throwing motion. Biomechanics are reasonably consistent from one pitcher to another. In my youth, I remember watching pitchers like Kent Colvey, Dan Quisenberry, Gene Garber. There was a guy named Rocker from the Braves, and these guys were side-armers. They were submariners, and studies have shown these people put additional stress on the elbow as well as the shoulder, so their biomechanics are a little bit different. At the bottom of the screen, we look at the six phases, starting with windup. early to late caulking, acceleration, deceleration, and follow through. We're going to talk about the biomechanics associated with each of these phases. Before we do that, let's just talk a little bit about the language related to the throwing motion. And we always start with what we call the kinetic chain. And this is basically the inference of generating force from the lower extremities all the way through the funnel, the scapula, through the shoulder to the release of the hand. The whole point being this is optimal coordination, multiple segments to disseminate forces. And that's the key. You want to disseminate the forces, and that leads to the efficiency of the task. When they release the ball, we know there's four areas of the body which contribute to the velocity. It's the trunk rotation, shoulder internal rotation, elbow extension, and wrist flexion. Studies have shown up to 50% of your force generated comes from the lower extremities in the throwing motion. Much like there is many of these arrows pointing in all different directions, when you have a chain, there are multiple points of breakdown due to various reasons. It can be endurance-related, flexibility, or strength. Deficits lead to problems down the road, and they can lead to injuries in performance. And there's often something called a catch-up phenomenon, where these breaks in the kinetic chain, they alter forces in distal segments, and that leads to the injuries or performance concerns. Busy slide. I'm gonna try to break this down a little bit more. So there's this principle called the summation of speed phenomenon. And what we're talking about here is this kinetic energy is derived from each rotation of the body segment. It's conserved and then transferred to the most distal segment, the so-called proximal to distal sequencing. And the summary of this is ineffective timing. You get higher joint kinetics. To compensate for these higher joint kinetics, you have to compensate for loss of momentum to maintain ball speed. So for example, if you had an issue related to your elbow above here, then all of these sequences down below within the throwing motion are going to be offset. And just one more on the linguistics of throwing and the so-called thrower's paradox. And this comes from Kevin Welk and James Andrews. This was in 2002. And what they said here is to maximize force, this elastic energy that can be transferred to the ball, structures must strike what we have, a delicate balance. And this delicate balance is this adequate laxity to achieve this full range of motion, this maximal external rotation, with sufficient stability to inhibit subluxation. So if you look at the picture here, you and I, we get about 90 degrees of external rotation. The average major leaguer has about 165. And you think about that anterior, the force on the humeral head and how it has to remain within the joint. It's unbelievable. Let's just talk about the delivery style. So there's this nodes, as they're called. And what they are these progressive motions described to achieve the overhead throwing motion efficiently. Nodes, they decrease the freedom. So they decrease freedom in the kinetic chain to achieve maximal torque with minimal force development. And you see here 50 Cent, right? He has one of the most infamous first pitches in Major League Baseball history, but give him a break. He's been shot over 50 times, so his nodes are going to be lacking. This is Ben Kibler's paper recently in 2016, which goes over these nodes. It's a good review. Eight nodes, we'll talk about them in a pictorial form in just one moment. This was a paper out of the Curl and Job Clinic looking at youth pitchers, and we're going to take some of the images right now. So when we're looking through the iPad, when we're looking through the iPhone, whatever recording device, this is what you want to see in your kids. A is correct, B is incorrect. So when they're entering early caulking, you want to make sure they have their pelvis leaning toward the plate. You don't want them upright and already entering early caulking because that's generating too much force on the throwing arm. Looking at the next picture beside, throwing hand on top, you never want to see them throwing the ball with their forearm or the ball in supination. That is incorrect. The elbow should always be at maximum height before or right at stride, at stride foot contact. The picture on the other side shows two examples. There's the closed shoulder with towards home plate, and also you see the foot down below, which is in line with home plate. So if you think about throwing across your body, if the foot opens up, all your force is being taken away. That's a waste of momentum and also a strain on the shoulder. And same if you close your foot in the opposite direction, that's a lot of force upon the shoulder. Looking at this long term at the bottom here, all we're saying is that they're achieving maximal external rotation as the arm is coming through. And lastly, you always want the hips facing home point, hips facing home plate rather. I'm not going to go through all these pictures, but this is an excellent article again by Glenn Fleissig. Very accessible online, Sports Health, and what he does is just goes through the pitching, the windup through the deceleration, tells you what to look for, and tells you what happens when it's not present, and it's a great review. And just to wind up biomechanics, this was a study from the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, and they looked at relationships between ball velocity and throwing mechanics in collegiate baseball players. This graph or table on the right shows you 9 kinetic variables that they looked at that have been well studied and documented via pitching motions, and they found 3 of them that made the difference between a pitcher who throws with a significant amount of velocity and someone who does not. And the 3 are if they have maximum shoulder external rotation in that late cocking phase, knee flexion at release. Glenn Fleissig said that you should have extension when the pitcher releases the ball. If you watch them from the side, they should have about 80% of their body height as far as if they cut their extension short and they're flexed, you're taking away speed. So knee flexion at release and, of course, trunk tilt at release. The more trunk tilt you have when you're throwing the ball, the longer you hold onto it, the more velocity you're going to generate. So why is this disabled throwing shoulder a setup? For the simple fact that it's one of the fastest human motions that can be recorded or ever recorded. When Glenn Fleissig initially studied this motion, he put up the camera, and he realized when he watched the footage, he was missing so many frames. And the reason for that is because shoulder internal rotation happens at about 7,000 degrees per second. In regards to forces that the shoulder generates, late cocking, when you get back in maximum external rotation, there's about 1 time the body weight generated on the anterior portion of the shoulder. When you hit follow through, the posterior cuff, the capsule, they hit about 1 to 1.5 times of body weight loading through, as you can see on this picture. And there's been numerous studies in regards to the ulnar collateral ligament, which cite the ulnar collateral ligament has a breaking point of approximately, they say, 32 newtons. The pitching motion delivers 35 newtons of force. So it's up to these other structures in the shoulder of the arm, and you must do this motion correctly in order to sustain a viable ulnar collateral ligament. Another big chart, but it goes back to those early x-rays I showed you. And it just talks about biomechanics of forces. In this study, they looked at youth, high school, collegiate, and professional, plain and simple. And at the bottom where I've started, what you see here is it doesn't matter in youth, high school, whatever the setting, they have pretty much equal forces throughout. You can see even youth athletes are hitting 7,000 degrees per second in shoulder internal rotation. So that's why we're seeing the pathology that we're seeing. That's why we're seeing these growth plates become affected with these young kids. And that's why they're going to benefit from what we're going to talk about today. So just to summarize the biomechanic portion, take time to observe them. I know we're busy. Time is precious for us. Just covering a minor league baseball team was enough. I can't imagine caring for an entire high school. That's got to be just, you have no time. But I think the time that you invest to watch these athletes is going to help you down the road in terms of preventing injuries, and that's going to be time taken away from you later on in the training room to take care of them. So what makes it difficult, and again, this is, I'm not here to talk about evaluation of the throwing shoulder. Just this throwing shoulder is inherently difficult to evaluate. The structures are deep. They're not always, you can't always say, I've palpated the structure. You have multiple examination procedures for the same structure. You could have multiple tests that are positive because there's so much overlap with structures. Pain patterns are obviously, they're not specific. And you also get the occasional zebra. I saw someone on Thursday who had, they started with a cervical MRI. 2 days later, had an MRI of the left shoulder, and I knew I was in for something with that patient, and I think they had thoracic outlet. We're working them up currently. In terms, just on a side, in terms of evidence-based shoulder evaluations, this was a paper by John Kane. He's a sports medicine doc out of University of Washington, and it's an excellent, I mean, he summarizes, you know, there's 30 different examination maneuvers for the shoulder, and he takes it and says, here's 9, 10, run with it, and he has a good summary. Just one other thing, when examining the patient, and this comes from Kibler and Burkhart Morgan's work, this is the second journal article of their series, and they talk about something called the Six syndrome with the scapula. If you're not evaluating your shoulders from the back, you're missing the whole point. And I remember reading this article, and I saw this picture on this side, and I said, holy cow, I know this guy just from the hair alone, right? And it said in the caption, this World Series pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, and it's Curt Schilling. And you can see here, I drew the line because you really couldn't see so much of the tilt without it. But left shoulder greater than right, he's a right-hander. And what do? They instituted 6 weeks of periscapular strengthening, and lo and behold, everything lined up. So you have to take a look at your athletes front, back. I usually have them hands by the side, hands on the hips, and have them do some repeated motions, forward plane and then abduction. Patients come to see me. We have x-ray in office. We've got ultrasound. Parents want imaging, of course. The athlete thinks he needs imaging because the parents want imaging, so let's talk about imaging. And this was a study done in the St. Louis Cardinal Organization, and they just did x-rays of the throwing of the dominant shoulder and elbow. And what they found was, of course, degenerative changes in the AC joint and the elbow. And the finding of the article was, it still didn't correlate with time spent on the disabled list. It's just findings you're going to see with people who do what they do. Looking at MRIs, this was a five-year follow-up, and they took 20 professional baseball players, and they did MRIs on the dominant and non-dominant shoulders. And what they found was 40% had partial or full thickness tears in the rotator cuff, 25% had Bennett's lesions. None of these people over the five-year follow-up required any intervention. It's just findings we know are there. This was a 2016 study from February, recent study, and they took major league draft picks with asymptomatic shoulders, did MRIs on them, and what did they find? 17-year-old, so a young kid already with a low-grade articular surface supraspinatus tear. This was a 19-year-old with already changes in the posterior labrum, so we know it's going to be there. And I always look for Dr. Andrews to make sense of these things, and what would he say? He would say, if you want an excuse to operate on a pitcher's throwing shoulder, just get an MRI, and he's absolutely right. So let's look at surgery for something as common as a slap repair. Slap repair is very common, 10% of all shoulder surgery, second most common arthroscopic procedure, and this was a 2014 study out of Houston, I think Methodist, and they looked at professional baseball players, and they looked at position players and pitchers, and this is the outcome, and I'll focus on just this side alone. So people entered non-surgical treatment, 40% returned to play. 22% returned to their previous level of competition. Okay, so we have surgical treatment of the non-surgical failures. Almost half returned to play, while only 7% returned to their previous level. So overall, surgery for slap repair, 62% returned to play, while almost a quarter only returned to play after treatment. So again, it doesn't guarantee you that you're going to get back to your previous level post-surgery. And once again, what would Dr. Andrews say? He would say our advice to baseball players is to avoid surgery on the throwing shoulder if at all possible. So let's talk about risk factors for these athletes. We know the biomechanics, we've talked about the forces. Let's talk about other risk factors we can perform and observe in the office. This was a Major League Baseball study over a five-year period, and they did preseason shoulder strength training. And what they found was there was statistically significant association observed with prone external rotation, seated external rotation, supraspinatus strength in regards to a throwing-related injury requiring surgical intervention. And as well, they found supraspinatus strength significantly associated with an incidence of any shoulder injury. So right off the bat, that's a focus for our pitchers. Continuing on, so we know the season is a season of attrition, 16 pitchers, 16 position players, and they looked at glenohumeral posterior tightness and scapular position. In regards to position players, there was no changes at the end of the season. Pitchers, they had less scapular rotation, which led them to injury. And again, the conclusion was pitchers may benefit from these initiatives, which we're going to talk about. A couple of high school studies. Again, looking at almost 100 pitchers and 28 upper extremity injuries with a trend for supraspinatus weakness for an increased shoulder injury. And the conclusion, again, looking at major injuries, these are injuries which caused greater than 3 games missed, preseason supraspinatus weakness was significant. Going over the strength and conditioning programs, I have two from the Andrews camp. One is a 4-week, one is a 6-week, and this was a 4-week program, control group, and the training group. And all they did was use some tubing exercises, a throwing program, and stretching 3 days a week for 4 weeks. And at the bottom, what you see here is a statistically significant amount of post-test gain in velocity. And while the control group did not show any improvement, that's not expected. Looking at the 6-week trial, they took 68 players, again, 14, 17 young people. They put them in 3 different forms of a strengthening group. That could have been throwers 10 group. They used these pneumatic machine exercises. They also used a plyometric program. And what they found was there was almost a 2% increase in throwing velocity, whichever strengthening program utilized for the upper extremity. And lastly, there was one more where all they did was this simple, what they called a posterior shoulder endurance test, where they just had the athlete take the arm out to the side and they measured how many times they could do that. And they put them through a program for 20 weeks, and the findings were not only did they maintain their flexibility, but they also gained strength and endurance. So lastly, let's just talk about implementation of a program. And yours truly on the baseball card back in the days. This was 1998, I think, and here's my buddy Doug Jura, who's with the Cubs. What will we say? You know, I always suggest the Advanced Throwers 10 program. And the reason behind this, there's so much evidence behind it. And the irony is, these two exercises aren't from it at all. I always like the push-ups with the plus, the diagonal D1, D2. These are from this article, again, from Andrews, where they looked at EMG of the muscles performed during the exercises. And so this is where they get their evidence for. Big pattern saying, guess what? The evidence behind the Throwers 10, it works. And certainly it does. This is just the outline of the program, and it can be implemented with simple physio ball. It can be implemented with a little tubing, some light weights. You're done. That's it. It doesn't take machines, none of the above. These are some of the exercises, and here we see Kevin Wilk assisting here with a little bit of overpressure and perhaps making things a little more difficult for this athlete. This gentleman here doing the abduction. And actually, when I read the article back in the days, this was the Devil Rays 98 number one draft pick, Jason Stanridge. And the point about this is, not that I know him, but the fact that this guy is 6'6", he weighs 240 pounds, and he's using these powder blue weights. And that's what we really need to focus on supervision. And I'll get to the supervision in just one moment. Because in the intro, when I asked the kid, okay, what exercises are you doing? I'm doing squat, I'm doing bench press. And 9 out of 10 times when I have kids come in the office, I'll say, well, demonstrate a squat for me. And their form is horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. They're doing more damage than good. I think we owe them a bit of supervision to make sure they're doing this correctly, okay? Because what people want to do, of course, is add more weight, which is not the point. When you add more weight, what do? You bring in other structures to perform the weight, and that throws the EMG studies out the window. So our point is we got to watch these guys and gals do the exercise. We see external rotation in a side plank. You see this gentleman keeping the arm in a stable position while exercising the other one. And what we would do, and I know, again, time is an issue. Time is certainly an issue. When I was with Tampa Bay, what we would do is have them do their program, then we would meet with them one-on-one, and we'd take them through it manually. So we'd have them do prone exercises manually. We'd have them do the D1, D2 supine, and we test their strength just to make sure they're in check. And for me, that's what it's about. It's that interaction with the athlete. I don't think it's about just saying, here's a recipe, follow it. You know, it's that interaction with the athlete. They're making sure we're checking in on them, and we are, and they're aware of that. We had all the layouts at LSU and in Tampa, you know, we had all the exercises listed on the wall. This is the day of media. What you can do is tell them to go to YouTube. That simple. The article's pretty dry, but if you go to YouTube, there's a 7-minute link, and it shows them how to do all these exercises, and it's done. And I recommend it to all the athletes, the two that I've seen in the office. That's what it's about. It's not about squatting and bench pressing and things that are going to ultimately not help you. It's about putting them on a better platform to perform. Of course, you know, you don't want to keep them just doing one set of exercises that gets to be a bit mundane. You know, variety, you want to mix it up for them. Some additional resources that I like. This was the update paper on the Burkhart trilogy. This was the 10-year update, which came out about 2-3 years ago. And at the end of this paper, they have just a slew of exercises for the overhead throwing athlete featuring the core, and it's a great read. And then Kevin Wilk, he also has another update. I think this was 2014, and again, has a great series of articles or a great series of exercises that can be added to and supplemented to that Advanced Throwers 10. Because they're, you know, athletes are going to lose their interest, and you got to keep them. You know, I'm not saying you have to do this every day. You don't have to do the whole thing every day, but you have to at least instill this at least 3 times a week, I would suggest. So in closing, we know it's a very high demanding task, this overhead throwing. You have to have proper mechanics to prevent injuries and to not impair their performance. The best time is to intervene early, and that's what I'm trying to do with these young kids with these horrendous x-rays. Baseball, people, you know, pick on it for being a sport of inactivity, but it's got some of the fastest motions ever recorded. Unfortunately, due to these forces and these rates of activity, we see injuries happening young. The key is we got to development. It's prevention, overwhelmingly. If we're not doing that, we're doing them a disservice. And we know the reality is, sadly, that surgical intervention does not assure that ideal outcome. Oh, and that was heads up for concussion. This is the kin for baseball, Pitch Smart. And this has all the recommendations, and I tell parents, this is what your kids need to be doing. This is a link for them to understand, you know, what is the appropriate approach to overhead throwing. And so I want to thank you for your time. And as a kid, I remember watching Nolan Ryan. He was one of my favorites. And there was this woman, Morgana, the Kissing Bandit, if anybody remembers her. She used to run out in the field and surprise like the big players of the day. And Nolan Ryan was such a class act. He took a knee and gave her a hug, and I always remember that as a kid. He's just a class act. And then here he is being a class act when Robin Ventura charged him out, someone who was double his age, and he got him in a headlock and punched him several times, and that was one of my favorite moments. So nonetheless, feel free to email me, michaelisison@gmail.com. I'll respond as soon as I can. And thank you for your time and your attention. Thank you.